Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, Episode 91, The Aztec Myths, an interview with Camilla Townsend. Today we have a special interview episode with the historian Camilla Townsend about her new book, The Aztec Myths. Camilla is a professor of history at Rutgers University, and one of her main research interests is the interactions between indigenous people and European colonists. She's explored this subject across the Americas, everywhere from Chesapeake Bay to the Andes. Perhaps the geographical area where she has focused the most effort is Mexico. You might remember from the series we did on the conquest of Mexico that, as well as Spanish sources, a number of Aztec writers also chronicled the period and provided a fascinating alternative perspective. She has written extensively about these texts, the context in which they were written, and what life was like in post-conquest Mexico. Her award-winning book, Fifth Son, tells the story of the conquest itself using these sources, and I found it extremely helpful when I was researching that series. It pointed me in the direction of documents and helped me understand what it was like for the indigenous people of Mesoamerica. Right back when I first started this podcast, I devoted the first 16 episodes to the indigenous peoples of Latin America before the Europeans arrived. Two episodes were on the Aztec, and because the subject is so vast, I was unable to cover more than an outline of their history, society, and religion. Luckily, today, we were able to add some detail to that scant introduction. In her new book, Camilla recounts some of the myths which formed a part of Aztec religion, but she also provides detailed and fascinating context about the society from which these myths were born. So, on to the interview.
Well, thank you for coming on, Camilla.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So I thought I'd start by asking about the origins of the Aztec, the Mexica. Every society has its foundational myths, and in the West, we like to emphasize facts and evidence, but I don't actually think that we're immune to this. We like to create our own myths when we talk about our nation states. So the Mexica had their own set of beliefs about where they came from, and some of these Western historians might say are based on legend. So what did the Mexica have to say about their origins, and how does this relate to Spanish and contemporary interpretations?
Well, I suppose you could say in a sense that the Mexica or the Aztecs had two different kinds of origin myths, one more literal and one more spiritual, and they both create a picture of them that's quite different from the picture that we were given by the Spaniards and even by modern historians. So on one hand, they believed that they live, that we all live under the fifth sun, that is, that the world had imploded four times previously and reemerged, like a new universe reemerging. And at the start of this, this fifth world, there was still no sun. And so the gods gathered together in the darkness with some wandering beings, human-like beings and animal beings, and asked someone to be brave enough to leap into a fire and self-immolate and become the sun. And a great hero, a warrior guy, volunteered to do this. And the god said, okay, that's fine, but is there anyone else? And no one else wanted to volunteer to burn themselves up, but the gods looked around and pointed to an ordinary guy. In fact, Nanahuatzin means little pimply one. So he was really an ordinary little young guy. And they said, you need to do this for everybody else. And he said, oh, I don't want to, but you know, the gods have been good to me, and if it's my duty, okay. So the great hero tries to jump in the fire, and he can't. You know, he comes running up to it, but, you know, it takes extraordinary courage to self-immolate. And then the ordinary guy, Nanahuatzin, whom the Mexica identified with, sort of forced himself to close his eyes and just run into the fire. And then he was burnt up and became the sun. And, you know, all of human beings and the Mexica, the Aztecs, have life because of his bravery. And that story is all about their own sense of self as kind of ordinary people who found the strength to do what is necessary to do for the future, for each other. Very different from the kind of image of self-aggrandizing, violent, imperialistic type of guys that the Spaniards painted them as being. Their sense of self was people descended of a scrappy young guy who just did what he had to do to help others. They also had another origin myth that was all about their coming down from Aztlan, probably a mythical place, but the idea was that it was someplace, you know, roughly where the American Southwest is now. And we'll never know exactly where that place was. And probably it wasn't one place because the migrants had come, you know, humans had migrated across the Bering Strait from Asia and had been coming down in waves successively. So there had probably been many places where the ancestors of the Aztecs had paused as they gradually made their way down into the warm farming lands of central Mexico. But they saw themselves, their male ancestors, in effect, as being these tough guys who came down from the north because their gods told them to do it, and then gradually intermarried with local girls, in effect, in the Central Valley of Mexico. And that is partly true. That is, we know from archaeology and from historical linguistics that their ancestors did migrate down like that in times of drought, et cetera. But they saw themselves as people, again, who had done what they had to do in partly because the gods wanted them to keep on moving, partly because they needed to do that to come down where the land was fertile in central Mexico. They didn't see themselves as being abusive people, but rather migrants from the north. It's a little bit ironic because everybody then wanted to come south to the beautiful agricultural lands of Mexico. They were fleeing the droughts in the war-torn area, what is today the United States. And of course, these days, everybody thinks that all human beings have always wanted to come north, you know, from Latin America up into the United States, but it not at all. The draw for many, many more centuries was towards the south. But that, of course, is just one of the ironies of history. In any event, they had these notions of where they came from that were really at variance with the stories that the Spaniards later told about them as being sort of arrogant, violent, tough guys who pushed other people around.
So you devote part of the book to a discussion of the source material, including the famous codices. So what do we have to work on, and what problems do they throw up when it comes to interpreting them?
So there are really two kinds of codices. There are the ones that you just referred to, the more famous ones, which are generally illustrated. That is, indeed, when Mesoamericanists use the word codex, they mean one of these traditional documents that is painted, that has pictures. And art historians and anthropologists have looked at these for many years and have learned a great deal from them. The problem is, when you look at an image, but you can't hear someone talk about it, you can't be absolutely certain what the people who painted it would have said, you know, or would have been thinking when they did this. It's a little bit like archaeological remains. They can tell you a great deal. But if you can't hear people talking freely and fluently, you can't really be sure. So, for instance, in the case of human sacrifice, you can have a drawing of human sacrifice or see an object from such a temple, and you don't know if people looking at that would have said, oh, yeah, I love this stuff. We did it every day. Or if people looking at it would have said, oh, it's one of the tragic necessities, that, you know, something that we have to do in highly spiritual moments every once in a while. There's a big difference there, and you can't know. So the codices have been problematic because people have looked at these paintings, these drawings, and have interpreted them, but it's tough to know what that people really meant. Only a very few survived, by the way, from before the conquest. Mostly when we're talking about the codices, we're talking about things that were painted in the 1500s, a few later. So there is this other set of sources, which are also sometimes called codices, but actually shouldn't be. They're alphabetic, meaning they are, you know, full-on words, endless paragraphs, hundreds of pages of paragraphs of writing. What happened was that the friars, the Spanish friars, mostly the Franciscans, but others as well, taught various indigenous young boys who were working with them the Roman alphabet so they could study the Bible and help proselytize their peers. And they did that. Many of them did that. But many of the indigenous took their knowledge of the alphabet home with them, you know, beyond, outside of the purview of the Spaniards, beyond, you know, off their radar screens, and would say to their fathers and grandfathers and great uncles, tell me the history that you used to tell, or, you know, tell me the story, or tell me the prayers that you used to pray. And they would write these things down in Nahuatl, the Aztec language, sounding it out, transcribing it, using the Roman letters. So if I want to say Nisiwa, I am a woman, they would say N-I, because they're spelling the way the Spaniards would spell, Nisiwa, C-I-C, like that. So we get, again, we have now hundreds of documents, thousands of pages written out in Nahuatl, full sentences, full paragraphs, you know, full pages, telling us about things that they believed or histories that they used to tell. And those, I think, are much more revealing even than the pictures. Now, I know in some ways a picture is worth a thousand words, but if you really can't hear the people talking who drew that picture or painted that painting, there, it's much less revealing. So this book that, that I've written, The Aztec Myths, is based on these stories that they wrote rather than Spanish or modern European understandings of drawings and pictures that were done sometime after the conquest. I'm really listening to the stories that they told, that people were telling in the 1500s, elders who had been alive before the conquest. So we're in many ways really hearing versions of the stories that they had told traditionally. So it's really wonderful. And I think, although a little work has been done with them in the past, more should have been. The problem is language barrier, basically. You know, it took a while for scholars to begin to really devote lots of time to these sources because of the years required to study Nahuatl. At least that's why I think less has been done with them.
It was maybe 10 years ago, there was that big viral panic about the Maya calendar and how it was supposedly going to end, which was basically based on a misinterpretation, I think. So a lot of people are aware that the Maya had this complex calendar. But I think a lot of people are less aware of the fact that the Mexica had one as well. And a couple of years ago, I was in Jalapa in Veracruz, and I was walking through the square and I stumbled across a group of Nahua, and they were celebrating the beginning of a new year. They had a circle of flowers and fruits, and they had statues of some of their gods and incense going, and they were all dressed up. And it was absolutely fascinating to see that this calendar was still observed in Mexico by people. It still exists today. So can you tell us a bit about how the calendar worked and how it related to their myths and deities?
Yes, you're touching on something very important. Most scholars, most archaeologists agree that the Mesoamerican calendar in effect originated with the Olmecs on the Isthmus, you know, the people with the statues of the big heads, if you've seen this in art history type books. And it spread to east and west so that you have peoples in the Central Valley as well as the Mayans whose calendars were really, I was going to say, very similar, or, you know, almost identical, although of course there are some differences, and in terms of the language being spoken, it was quite different. So the way they described the months or the days were different, but the Nahuas, quite comparable to the Mayas, had two calendars going at all times. So on one hand, they kept careful track of the sun, and they had a 360-day calendar plus a five-day blank period. It was called the Nemontemi, the period of void, the period of needing to be filled up. And they would pray and hope and wait with some confidence that they would pass through it, and a new solar year would begin. And that they used that year to record history and to know when to plant and when to plow and all the things that farmers must do. But at the same time, always they had a ceremonial calendar going, which consisted of 20 day signs. And these 20 days inherently were very similar to the ones that the Olmecs had and that the Mayas had. And these 20 days appeared in series of 13 13 numbers, so that you had 20 times 13 or 260 days total that constituted this ceremonial calendar. No one knows for sure where it came from, but the theory that most subscribe to is that it's actually related to the human gestational period. That's very close to the number of days that your typical woman is pregnant. In any event, at any point in time, most people knew where they were in the solar year, but also where they were in the ceremonial year. And it sounds sort of too complicated to be believed, but I like to remind all of us that we kind of do the same thing, although on a simpler level. We have the solar year and we know where we are with that. But we also have this endlessly repeating series of 7 days that are mostly named for Norse gods, right? The Moon Day, Tuesday, and Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Freya's Day, et cetera. And we have no problem knowing that it's Freya's Day as well as the 20-something of March in such a year. And those things are entirely separable. If someone picked up the day of the week and moved it, we could all learn to roll with that, okay, and then pick right back up with the Monday through Sunday thing. So they, in effect, were doing the same thing all the time. Their ceremonies, their religious ceremonies, were kept track of according to the ceremonial calendar. But then there were some ceremonies that were marked by the solar calendar. And again, they were fine with this. It's possible that only the priests really kept track of both all the time, and that ordinary people were just taking the word of the priests. But I suspect that most average human beings were fine with keeping track of both at the same time. Their gods, as you say, were tightly tied with this. Certain dates were related to certain gods, and you were to remember those gods on those dates. There were multiple dates involved. Later, a myth developed among the Spaniards that they had been expecting, the god Quetzalcoatl to return to Earth in the year one reed. That's not true. The god Quetzalcoatl was associated with many different dates, including the year one reed, but there was no story alive at the time that he was going to come to Earth as a human being in that year. Just that during that year, it was one of the years that was associated with him. Every god had multiple calendar dates associated. And certain days were understood to have spiritual powers that were more positive or more negative. If your kid was born on a certain date, you would want that to be marked if it was a good date. On the other hand, if your kid was born on a date with negative energy, you could bring the soothsayer to your house and they could advise that you mention that the kid was born the next day, after midnight. These things could be adjusted. So they very much believed in all this, but they also thought that it was fine to kind of work with the gods. Maybe it was after midnight that the kid was born and kind of roll with it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You were saying that gods are associated with certain days. You also mentioned sacrifice earlier. The impression I get is that to the Mexica, deities were things that could be interacted with in everyday life. So what do we know about how they interacted with these deities?
Right. The mythical version that was created by Spaniards later and has been accepted for years is that the Aztecs had this morbid obsession with death, and they felt that they had to sacrifice, hundreds or even thousands of people every day in order for the sun to rise. I just don't find that in the Nahuatl sources at all. There's no question that the act of sacrifice was sacred, as it is actually in all religions. And there's also no question that at the peak of their power, the Aztec ruling family weaponized that practice. They used that practice to terrorize their enemies. They actually say that. We used to try to, bring people that we wanted to conquer or incorporate into the empire to watch the worst of the ceremonies at the peak of our power and scare them into joining us. Because if they didn't join us, we might attack. And if they lost the battle, we would then sacrifice dozens of their kids. So there is this belief in sacrifice in the background, but we mustn't imagine that they always believed in this sort of hideous vision that was being used as a terror tactic at the peak of their power. For most of their, several centuries of existence and 100 years of power in the Central Valley, they had a much subtler sense of spirituality. Human beings, in effect, lived in what we might think of as a pantheistic rather than polytheistic world. That is, there's that of God everywhere. The gods are everywhere. The divinity, the principles of divinity is everywhere. And human beings, if they're fortunate, can access that, can feel that, can notice it. And some things help us more than others. A beautiful poem or story may put us in touch with divinity. Mica in a stone, the bits of stone that glitters, or polished turquoise stone, extraordinary feather from a tropical bird, extraordinary rainbows or sunsets may help us feel that we are in touch with that which is divine in the universe all around us. So it was a very deep view and a very celebratory of life. Always they were seeking to celebrate life, to be grateful for life, for the beauties that we are surrounded by. And the very, very negative, very death-involved view that we have come to think of as being associated with the Aztecs really isn't in their sources. It isn't in what they wrote or what they thought about at all.
There's a section in the book which looks at the immediate post-conquest history of Mexico and the imposition of Catholicism on its people. Today, Catholicism is dominant, yet it's infused with all sorts of syncretic traditions which have their roots in the time before the conquest. What do we know about how the indigenous myths and beliefs were affected by this initial phase of Spanish rule?
Right, Max. I think you've put your finger on a crucial issue in Latin American history. Anyone wandering the byways of Latin America now, Mexico, Ecuador, anywhere else, and then wandering the byways of the back streets of Spain would conclude, if they were only there for a few days, that this is not the same religion, even though, in fact, you'd be observing practicing Catholics in both places. But the Catholicism or the Christianity that emerged, I would almost say evolved in Latin America, is quite different in key regards. It isn't so much that Christianity changed the stories that they told. Many of those indigenous stories are still told today. And you mentioned yourself, running across people who were practicing ceremonies that have been practiced for many years. The language, Nahuatl language, is still very vibrant. And, with it have survived many of the prayers and ceremonies. But rather, sort of a sense of spirituality, of Catholic spirituality that emerged, was different than it would have been because of the existence of this sort of separate track of indigenous religion. So there was even more interest in the many faces of God in the Trinity, in the Virgin Mary, in the various saints in Latin America than there is, I would argue, in Spain. Not that there isn't interest there as well, but that sort of the many faces of God is really paramount, I think it's fair to say, in Latin American Catholicism, at least in certain places and certain times. And I think that comes from the fact that in people's heads, there was, and in many cases still is, this other religion that is very different. Mexico, for instance, is famous for its Day of the Dead, All Saints Day over in Europe, but it's quite different in Mexico, where the people really are communicating with parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, those who have died. And that was a key element of Nahuatl or Aztec religion, that we must remember each other because this world, this earth, this time that we have, it's as close to heaven as most of us are ever going to get. And we must appreciate it and delve into it. You do that, you do honor to people and help them live on by remembering them here on earth, which is quite different from the All Saints Day or the Halloween that exists in Europe. And yet at root, it is the same holiday. It's just that holiday as practiced by people who came from a different perspective. So it creates, between the two traditions, we have, I guess I would say, almost a third tradition that is neither Nahuatl-based religion nor Catholicism, the way the Pope might understand it, but is almost something else. Of course, as good Christians, many of its practitioners would say to me, no, it is Christianity. So perhaps I shouldn't really say it's a third thing, a thing unto itself, but it certainly is a very different style of Christianity.
I don't know if you if you haven't had enough time to look at it or know anything about it, that's fine. But I was just wondering if you knew anything about these new codices.
Yes, there have been three new codices that have emerged from a particular rural area, and the people working on them are excellent scholars. There's Rafael Tena, whose Nahuatl is the best, and Maria Castañeda de Paz, who is a Spaniard but has lived and worked in Mexico for many years, and someone else whose name escapes me, forgive me. And so they are looking at these. They are the traditional kind of codices that scholars usually mean when they say codices, that is, they're full of pictures, they're full of paintings. But there is some Nahuatl writing on them as well. If they were just the paintings, I would say, ah, yes, there have been many of these discovered over the years, and there will be many more. And the truth is, we don't really know what the people were, in a full sense, trying to say. But because there is some Nahuatl writing, we will be able to work with these in very meaningful ways. They're the kind of source that would have been part of a book I wrote, about Nahuatl or Aztec history based on the Nahuatl language sources. Someone redoing that book, doing their own version of it years from now, will also include these new sources because they include Nahuatl writing. And better yet, they're from the Central Valley tradition. So they will give us a better sense of the Aztecs themselves. Sometimes things emerge elsewhere in Mexico from other Nahuatl speakers, but not from the Central Valley. So we don't really learn about the Mexica, the people that we mostly mean when we say the Aztecs. No one called themselves the Aztecs at the time. It's a bit confusing. The people that we usually mean when we say that word are the people who were in charge at that time, the Mexica. But sometimes we use the word Aztecs to mean any Nahuatl speaking person who lived anywhere in Mexico at the time that the Spaniards arrived. So that word Aztec, because it's a more modern invention, can be a bit confusing. But in any event, these come from the Central Valley, so they really will tell us more about what was going on at the heart of power and not just from some peripheral, area that had relatively little political significance. So, yeah, I look forward to hearing more about what the scholars who presented them to the world have to say about it. And then later, if I live so long, hearing what young people learn from them and add to our knowledge from them.
Excellent. Well, that sounds exciting. I'm looking forward to it as well. So the
Yes.
book is published by Thames and Hudson, and it's released on June the 4th. Go out and get it if you're interested in what we've covered today. Thank you for coming on, Camilla.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsargent.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica, and that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @historylatinam. And if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsargentphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.